You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Maryland sports fans, there's only one sports book in the great state of Maryland with over 50 years experience booking bets and supporting customers. Betfred Sportsbook at Longshots is now open and is the only sports book in Frederick offering cash betting on football, basketball, world soccer, and more. Visit the Betfred Sportsbook at I-270 and MD-85 in Frederick, right next to Longshots off-track betting. Go to betfredsports.com for more information and your chance to win exclusive merchandise. Must be 21 or older. Play responsibly. For help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hey, everybody. This is Baco, and I'd like to welcome you to the debut episode of Whatever Nevermind. What is Whatever Nevermind? Well, I thought I'd go ahead and break it down for you before we get going into this week's episode, the very first and ever episode. When I first started thinking about doing a sidecast, my criteria was pretty much this. I didn't want to do a copy of Cobras and Fire because that ain't going anywhere. Luce and I are still going to be churning out episodes at least a couple times a month. And it needed to be rock-centric because it's still going to be on the Cobras and Fire feed, as you can clearly see. And, you know, there's enough Kiss podcasts out there. So while I could definitely do a show on Kiss, I don't know that I could add anything to the conversation that isn't already being taken care of. But one thing that came up in 2019, Luce and I did an episode on the Alice in Chains record Dirt, and the reaction to that really made us realize that grunge doesn't have a lot of love in the podcast world, aside from all the Carnival Souls episodes that some of those Kiss podcasts have done. In fact, a lot of music-themed podcasts are started by people who kind of resent grunge and what it represents. Still upset, I guess, that Columbia didn't give Dog Eat Dog a bigger push. But so there is kind of a hole there, at least. We could be down in a hole if you want to go that direction. Thinking about that, there's this podcast called The 500 with Josh Adam Myers, where he is counting down the Rolling Stones' 500 greatest albums of all time. I'm going to do that, but with grunge. So 0 points to me for creativity. I'm really just hoping everybody's going to tune in for the content, I guess. That's what I'm banking on. Each week, I'll have a guest host, and we will be counting down Rolling Stones' 25 greatest grunge albums. The list is out there if you want to see what's coming up, but maybe it'll be more fun if you just kind of check it out as we go along here. I know Rolling Stone sucks, but this appealed to me because on this list are records I don't like, haven't heard of, sort of forgotten. And sticking to an outsider's list, it kind of frees you up. At the same time, it challenges you. So this is, it's just a way to kind of keep things interesting. At least that's my goal. If it sucks and it's not any damn fun, I'm going to quit pretty quick. So you have a promise there. I'm also going to be asking my special guest host each week to give me their own personal ranking of these 25 records only. And if we actually make it to the number one album, we'll have 25 episodes. And at that point, we'll have our own kind of re-ranked top 25, kind of using like an average basis going through it. So I'm going to do some math at the end. So you know that's going to be fun. As for when you can look for these episodes, all I can tell you is I plan to drop these on Tuesdays when we don't have a Cobras and Fire episode ready. That includes the interviews we do and all that kind of stuff. So maybe 2 a month, sometimes less. And like I said, if this totally sucks and it's not fun, I'm going to bail anyway. So, but I'm pretty sure this is going to be cool. And also, with it being 25, we know there's only going to be 25 episodes. I hope in that time if I either won't want to do sidecasts anymore or I'll have a much better idea of what I want to do. But that's about it. Let's do this. Whatever, never mind. Episode 1. See, what is it called? Whatever, never mind. Okay.
What's my it's your show.
Welcome to the very first episode, the debut episode of Whatever, Never Mind, where Baco goes deep on grunge. My name is Baco. I'm your host. I'm joined by a very special guest, fellow Twin Cityan, Andy Schall. Andy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Baco. It's a pleasure to be in the dungeon basement studios here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you, man. You brought us gifts, so let's why don't you tell the listeners what you brought me here?
Well, at my local liquor store, I've seen this on the shelf for about the last 6 months, and I've just been hesitant to buy it. And I knew I was going to be on the show today, so I stopped in the liquor store and picked up a couple, a four-pack of Iron Maiden Trooper Premium British Beer. Hello. One-pint cans.
What do you say we crack these babies open and see what they taste like, all right? A run to the hills with this one.
Yes. Ace is high indeed.
Yeah, this is it's a grunge themed show though. Shouldn't you have brought like a, I don't know, a six pack or a sixer of Rainier? Yes. Can you even get that locally anymore?
I don't think so.
Have you heard of Rainier beer?
Oh yeah.
Okay. I remember because that was almost like one of the byproducts of like grunge kind of blowing up, is that suddenly everything Seattle became cool, like Starbucks.
Yes.
And this shitty beer called Rainier, which was named after Mount Rainier, which is apparently in Washington State somewhere.
There used to be Rainier draft commercials on 93.7 or 93X back in the early 90s.
Was it The Edge?
Before The Edge, when it was hard rock.
That's right, that's right. They actually were playing like Jackal one day, and it was R.E.M.
There we go. Actually, that's where I got back into Kiss, because they were playing Revenge.
Oh, that's right. 92. You know, I first heard... welcome to the Kiss podcast. I first heard Unholy. Me and my roommates stayed up for like an hour. They kept going, and coming up next, the new Kiss song. You know, and it took like an hour. We were doing dishes and doing all this shit waiting to hear this damn thing. But yeah, when it did, it just blew our fucking minds. Like, it's the greatest song ever.
Yeah, I got stuck listening to I Just Wanna. So.
Oh, that's not too bad. Yeah. That's a little bit of a ripoff of, is that Cochran song, right? Summertime Blues.
Oh, yeah.
Where the fuck was I going? See, this is what happens when I do a podcast.
You know, this tastes what the essence of Bruce Dickinson is like, I'm sure.
The essence of Bruce Dickinson. You know, there's a dick in his name.
Well, not in my mouth.
Yeah, all right.
Now. Well, the night's still young. I don't know.
Yeah, all right. But yeah, was the Rainier commercial, was it like Rainier?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Or
Rainier draft. Thank you.
Yeah, fuck.
Something like that.
Oh, draft beer. What a fucking joke that was. It's like,
yes.
It's like keg beer taste in a can. What was the point of that? It's kind of like Keystone had the bottled flavor in a can.
Yes.
It's like, why would I not just get a bottle of beer?
You're bringing me back to my high school drinking days with Keystone talk and Rainier draft talk.
All right, so. Right on. Well, let's get into the kind of the whole point of what I'm doing here.
There is one?
Oh, yeah, a little bit. I explained it in the intro to this show that people will hear, but just to catch everybody up to speed, basically, I'm going to count down the 25 greatest grunge albums according to Rolling Stone. Now, again, I don't have a whole lot of respect or love for Rolling Stone, but I kind of like the idea that you stick to a list that isn't yours. And it's almost like, first of all, it kind of frees you up a little bit that you don't have to overthink things and you can kind of follow a pattern, but it's also a little bit of a challenge to kind of stick to it because... I know you're not a big grunge fan, just based on our conversations prior to this, but if I was to make my own top 25, it would look a lot different than this.
Yes, and actually, I would probably take a couple bands off. Well, for certainly the Stone Temple Pilots, because I've never really considered them grunge.
Okay.
And they have, what, like two or three albums in the top 20?
They definitely got two.
Purple and the other one.
Yeah, the other one. not Tiny Music. Core.
Yes.
But now we're spoiler alert. Yeah, the list is out there. I mean, if people want to ruin the experience for themselves or just whatever, see what's coming up. Go ahead, check it out. It's actually a top 50 list, but I did not want to commit to 50. I was like, because I'm really kind of thinking by the end of this. I'll either be sick of doing a side cast, we'll be too busy with Cobras on Fire, or I'll have a much better idea that's actually a little more unique to mine. I actually stole this whole concept from another podcast, counting down the 500 greatest just albums in general that Rolling Stone put together. So, but anyway, we'll have some fun. I do like grunge music a lot. I definitely bought into it, the counterculture and all that kind of stuff at the time.
I had a flannel shirt back in the day.
That was the great thing about grunge is that basically it was the first time that there was like a pop culture movement where I already owned all the clothes. The only thing I couldn't afford was the Doc Martens.
Yes, they're very true. And what I didn't have, I could just steal from the back of my dad's closet because, you know, he had a couple old flannel shirts just laying around. So
There's zero chance that I didn't do that. Yeah. And even like long underwear, like being seen, you know, was like not a big deal. So. Anyway, I did look up, I'll do a little research. I found out something from study.com that basically what is grunge? And this is how they describe it. Let's see if you, me, and the listeners agree. Guitars, heavy rock, heroin, plaid shirts and ripped jeans, Doc Martens and Converse, guys with long, messy hair. That seems kind of fair.
True.
Again, this is all from something called study.com. The word grunge actually means dirt. The distorted and dirty guitars and vocals, as well as the sloppy appearance of the band members. And this alternative rock could be one reason for the use of this word. I didn't really read that very clean, but who cares? The actual first person known to coin the term grunge was a writer, Paul Ramble. Never heard of the guy. He wrote for NME, New Musical Express, the British magazine. I have heard of that. Yeah. But apparently he used it in a 1978 article. But many people give a Mark Arm from Green River. Did they have an album in the top 25, do you recall?
They do.
Okay. All right. Now, that's one of the ones that I didn't really get into. I know the name Mark Arm, and I know him from Green River, but I never got into them as far as that. Other than I think they have a song in the single soundtrack.
Yes, I believe so. And then I had read a couple years ago that book that was the oral history of the Seattle sound. Like Everyone Wants to Live in Our Town or something to that effect, which was a pretty good book. I remember him talking about Green River and a lot of the bands we're talking about here. But I was just reading it as an outsider reading about grunge.
Okay.
So not like I was familiar with most of the bands that they were discussing.
A little bit later, I'll kind of touch on it. We can share our stories as far as what our personal relationship to this music is, if there even is one. But we should probably crack the egg on this omelet and at least mention what we're doing today. We have, coming in at number 25, is the Melvins' 1991 record, Bullhead. Now, much to the chagrin of Joey Haney, I was not able to track down somebody who liked the Melvins when I first was reaching out to people that I thought to join this podcast. Yep. It dawned on me just a couple days ago. You and I had already talked about doing this a few weeks ago.
Right.
And you agreed to be the guinea pig, said, fuck it, I'll listen to the damn record, I'll come down, we'll talk about it. And so I really appreciate that. But it just dawned on me the other day, like, fuck, I should just launch this thing out into that page that Chris just started, the podcaster conversation group on Facebook, and I did. So I got a lot of feedback. One of them was Joey Haney saying, and he listed off a bunch of bands, so I'll get Joey on the show for sure. But I was like, Melvin's motherfucker. I actually messaged him right away. He's like, god damn it, you know, because I like Melvin's. But I actually was happy that they opened for Kiss on the reunion tour and they came through here.
Oh.
You know, I mean, because I think they were changing up a lot of bands. But oddly enough, I've probably heard, I don't know, I own at least a half dozen of their records.
Okay.
This is not one of the ones I'd ever heard, though. How about you?
My relationship with the Melvins was I'd only hear about Kurt Cobain referencing them in interviews and wearing like their T-shirts and stuff. So I had zero clue about the music. I just knew it was heavy and the forefathers of the grunge movement, if you will.
I do think they kind of epitomize the tonality qualities you look for in grunge. We'll break that down a lot more as we get into some of these tracks. But you brought up, obviously, Kurt Cobain dropping or Kurt Cobain name dropping these guys once Nirvana kind of broke. I do kind of like how the Seattle scene helped each other out because, you know, being someone who was part of the Minneapolis music scene, I didn't really experience anything like that. It was more competitive. It was more, you know, here's the, you know, step on people, you know, and we're talking about, and I'm not talking about people that like sold millions of records at the, it's like, well, I got the third slot and I kind of sandbagged you and you have now the fifth slot. Or if it's a weeknight, you're headlining thanks for coming, you know, because, you know, nobody's there.
Right.
Like, even the band that fucking booked the show leaves.
Yeah.
So, back to Kurt Cobain. There are some interesting notes. Dale Crover, no, basically the Melvins, I should say before I say this, has been two guys, King Buzzo, yep, and Dale Crover. For, you know, if Craig Smith actually listens to this episode, there is a more ridiculous name than Loose Cannon, King Buzzo. But he still goes by Buzzo or Buzz, but the two of them, and they had on bass basically a Spinal Tap member. Yes. It was just self-destruct all the time. They've had just a ton of them. But Dale Crover played drums with Nirvana early on, long before they broke and all this stuff. And Buzz Osborne, which is King Buzzo, he would actually introduce Kurt Cobain to Chris Novoselic and Dave Grohl. This is according to Wikipedia, so none of that's probably true. But I do know this one thing is to be true, that their bass player for a good stretch of time during this period and on this record we're going to talk about today was a girl they called Lorax. Her real name is Lori Black, and she's the daughter of Shirley Temple.
I knew Shirley Temple's daughter was a bass player, but I didn't realize she played for the Melvins. And it was just blowing my mind, because once we start talking about some of these songs, I'm just trying to picture Lori going home and saying, "Mom, here's my new album. Here's a song. Here's the lead track, Boris." And, you know, Shirley Temple, Good Ship Lollipop. What the hell are you going to do with Boris?
It says here that Bullhead is a slower, more droney music style for the band.
Yes,
I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that. That's their music. I don't know. You mentioned like bringing the record home. What did you think of the album cover? Let's talk about that for a second.
Oh gosh! I was gonna say it was the bowl of fruit.
It's like a basket with grapes, a couple apples, pineapple, glass of wine.
Do you remember the old '40s singer Carmen Miranda?
Who danced that's
the
her
fruit
hat.
Basket.
There you go. Yeah,
and a glass of vino in front.
Well, let's just break down the statistics of the record here. It was released on May 3rd, 1991, on I think it was CV. Did I get that right? I can't find it now. CV Records, I don't know. Oh, no,
nope.
Boner.
Boner Records.
All right.
Someone Boner was a fan of Growing Pains in the 80s.
Exactly. As, what's his name's best friend?
That's right. Seaver.
Mike Seaver. it was produced by somebody called Jonathan Burnside. I had to look him up. It turns out he's produced a ton of shit. Most of it not notable. He's still going, but these aren't bands that I've heard of. But he did a bunch of more Melvins records. Like, he even did the Houdini record, which is one of my favorite ones by them. He also produced, I think it's the debut record from Clutch, Transnational Speedway League. He was a co-engineer on the Faith No More's record, Album of the Year, and Fu Manchu. I'm not familiar with this record, but I do like the Fu, Kept Between Trees on Slap and Ham Records. That's probably why I haven't heard of that one. Never heard of that record label.
No,
but,
kidding.
Jonathan Burnside, quite the producer of records I've never listened to.
So he's got that going for himself.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, he's got a gig, right? And again, the lineup on this record is on drums, Dale Crover, Buzz Osborne on guitar and vocals, and Lorax, Lori Black, daughter of Shirley Temple, on bass. So when you did your research, did you come across anything of interesting note or any oddball things that kind of popped out at you besides Shirley Temple?
Well, the fact that Gene played bass with them at a concert in '93.
Oh, right, because they were going blind. Did you ever hear the story that they actually got bumped from that Kiss My Ass tribute because Flavor of the Month, Dinosaur Jr. guy, who, by the way, would go on to say he couldn't give two shits about Kiss.
Yeah.
They bumped Melvins, who had been huge fans. They actually did a parody of the solo albums. Where like the three members did like the album covers look just like the Kiss solo albums.
Oh, nice.
And they all have like three or four songs. But true Kiss fans, and I actually give grunge credit for that, if anything, is like, because remember during the 80s, I don't give a fuck what anybody says. Motley Crue, Rat, Warrant, Poison, Trickster, these bands were not praising Kiss.
They were trying
to distance themselves from them a little bit, you know, like, oh, we're not that. But once Nirvana broke, suddenly all these bands were like, fucking Kiss. You know, even Pantera was coming up around that time, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So at least there's that. What else you got?
Let's see here. Well, the genres that this album gets lumped into is pretty unique.
You mean besides grunge?
Besides grunge.
Well, besides alternative or Seattle sound? What
exactly.
do you got?
Exactly. So we have stoner metal.
You know, I guess I can kind of see that a little bit, but I think, God, they just don't have the... Okay, carry on. I don't necessarily agree with that one.
All right.
I can see why they do.
Sludge metal, which I can see this is like molasses in December, just kind of slow laboring roll.
Definitely sludgy.
Yeah. Alt metal and hardcore punk. So it kind of gets lumped in with all of that.
Hardcore.
Yeah.
Scott Ian and I have an issue
with
that.
Very true.
You understand, Scott Ian and I used to get our asses kicked going to hardcore shows. No, I don't necessarily agree with that. But yeah, whatever. Fuck it. Call them all sorts of different things, right?
So, yeah. And it's kind of they're kind of the forefathers, like we said, of grunge.
Yeah, because this
kind
is
metal.
Their third record in 91. And they had an EP before their first actual full length. And, Gluey Porch Treatments, I believe, was the first record. I own that one somewhere. That was a little weird. I actually looked up some YouTube footage of them on this tour.
Okay.
And I found a full concert from Chicago. And I have only seen King Buzzo with that giant fro that he had. I don't know if you know what he looks like.
I was going to say, it kind of reminded me of some of the pictures I saw of Sideshow Bob.
Oh, yeah, that's a great visual for the listener. But yeah, around this time, he had like kind of a buzzed haircut with just kind of a weird kind of straggly thing kind of dripping down over his head. So he hadn't really kind of gone full on fro yet. And now he's like full on fro gray and white. And and he either knows somebody, like was he part owner of Grumpy's in Minneapolis? Or there's some connection there because they played there a lot before it closed.
Okay.
The one down by the stadium there.
Off Washington?
Yeah.
Okay.
For all you
Minneapolis people.
Yeah. for the Twin Cities listeners.
Holy crap, the one down off downtown.
We sound like New Yorkers now. Yeah, so, you know, over there on 42nd and 23rd, right? Yeah. It was like, I talk like everybody knows the fucking landmarks, you know what I mean? Yeah,
that's
it's
right.
Like, but
take the 7 train to that one, right?
Yeah, we're the Minneapolis, so fuck that. We can do it too. And this Trooper beer is tasting good.
Yeah, it's not bad.
So let's get into the record a little bit. I had a chance, like I said, this was my first time listening to it. I actually listened to it, I think, about 4 times. And it's basically one really long song.
Yes, it is.
But
very long.
Since we're trying to do an actual episode of a show here, let's go track by track. What do you say?
Let's do it.
Up with Boris, and let me see, the notes I have here are, if you've never heard the Melbournes before, and this is the first thing, this actually is a fair representation of what they are, with one exception. The song is 8 minutes and 35 seconds long. They typically don't go, I mean, that long. To me, at that point, once you get into about the 5-6 minute mark and you don't know when it's going to end, this is like Tool's Idiot Stepbrother. You know, as I like to say, but...
Well, that and the whole album's only 35 minutes long, so for this one, it'd be 8.5 minutes.
It's the opening track.
Jesus Christ, let's get to... And we never get to a chorus.
Ever.
Ever. There's no melodies. There's no hooks. There's no fucking background vocals. I mean, they got Lorax and Dale. I've never heard them sing backup on any of these tracks. So it's strictly King Buzzo, you know, just leading the song.
Let's get a little taste of the lyrics for the listeners here. I'm not sure where the best part to pick it. This is also, I mean, not just the longest song, but this is the they have, this easily has the most lyrics.
Yes.
Which is kind of, this actually has a lot of lyrics, but I'm going to read a little bit from verse 3, if that's what it's called. It's a killer, she's a killer maker. It reaches in and takes from the back of your mind. I'm not awake, still alive. $20 has the back and the and see the lines. I got a small, got what they call the lack, a lack of halfway cooked, but it's my own. That really, that line in particular touches me. I feel the pain or joy. Not sure where he's going here, but I feel it.
Heroin buy?
Yeah, heroin. You know, I do believe Buzzo's been clean his whole life, a straight edge.
Yes, I think I read that as well, that he does not partake in any booze or alcohol.
Yeah, he definitely does now, but he's not the reason that Seattle went all heroin-y, no. But which is kind of a bummer because, you know, we need something interesting to talk about, and actually these guys are kind of boring.
A little bit.
So yeah, I gave this 5-star. Or I gave this 5 Doc Martens out of 5.
5 Doc Martens. The song.
Yeah. What would I didn't ask you to rate them, but let's pull it out of your ass. What do you got?
I would give it a 2.
A 2.
Because it's 8.5 minutes long.
Okay.
On a 35-minute album, and it's the first track. So I'm just like, fucking hey, let's get to it, man. And like I said, there's no melody, there's no hooks, there's nothing to keep you going. It's just one long monotonous song, and I said he does more snarling than singing. You know, it's it's not really like I said. There's not a lot of melody in this. So,
do you think that they recorded it and it was actually about 2.5 minutes? And then when the album was done, they're like, "This thing's only 32 minutes. We need at least 6 more minutes. Let's go back and re-record Boris. I got some more lyrics."
If you like low end frequencies, this is your song.
This album.
Yeah, well, the whole album too, but this song in particular just is kind of low and dark, dank sounding.
You know, so. I think he missed the boat. He should have got, like, when they signed to a major label, he should have got a signature guitar deal with like Gibson or somebody, and there is no frets past the 5th fret. It's just like, I don't need them. Yeah. Just,
why have frets at all?
Fretless bass, I suppose. There, but all right. Anything more on Boris?
No, not really.
I did mark down that at the 6:13 mark, you think the song is over, and then it just sort of starts over.
Yeah,
you know, it goes back to the beginning, yeah. and oddly that you can actually tell it is, but it's kind of like that. They kind of go like lighter, like Eddie Talk sings like this, but yeah. So again, 5 Doc Martens off. So I give it a 5 out of 5. All right. Up next is Anaconda. A little more brisk. 2:24. Yeah, we're probably just going to read a lot of these lyrics because they're so fucking ridiculous. But like a sore, I wonder if these are right. Like a sore, a lore, a lie, what tells a mind to mine, Ruff, like rough dog, Ruff, sewed in Mullins a heartbreaker, cause she lonely sell, like moaning woes to lie sin, cause she's a keen. What do you think?
Very
fucking Shakespeare.
Very reminiscent of Paul McCartney, Moon Spoon in June.
yeah, you know, you got
not a lot of rhyming schemes going on.
I wonder how often Buzzo's lyrics get compared to the lyric stylings of Paul McCartney.
Oh, no matter what the man said.
Yeah, you know, when Paul backed out of like the Beatles reunion with Julian Lennon, they were this close to doing it with Buzzo.
Sure, I could see that happening.
Oh, man.
I don't know if Ringo could quite pull off, you know, the same drum styling as Dale Crover, but...
Well, how would you describe the drumming? Because I'm familiar with it, but I'm like, fuck, I'm not sure. It's like a lot of tom work, but it's not... Is it jazz?
Ooh, good question.
Like Bill Ward?
Not on this song, but on some of the other songs, it gets a little more, you know, you get a little more fills going, like, finally, and it's driving. But yeah, it's interesting. He plays loud. He plays fucking loud.
Oh,
for
yeah.
Sure. I mean, reminiscent of like a John Bonham.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
And I guess
people right now are probably shitting themselves. Like they were okay with the Beatles comparison, but right now it's like, oh, you did not just fucking compare Dale Crover to John Bonham.
I'm sorry, guys.
Oh, man.
And just as far as loudness and thundering.
Course, of course, that's what you were saying. Yeah, thundering, no, he's, look, he might be as good. Fuck if I know. He just doesn't show it on this stuff. It's like, it is weird. It is like, again, Tool's idiot stepbrother. I mean, it kind of is reminiscent of somebody who's like a really big Tool fan,
yeah,
but not very good.
Sure.
It's like, oh, I love, what's the Danny Carey, I think is the Tool drummer. He's like, yeah, that's my guy, but I'm just not that good. So I just, this is what I do. Kind of shrugs and like, eh. Like he's in the studio like, how is that? Also, as someone who's actually had to learn a Melvin song.
Yes.
I'm curious if they struggle remembering how to play their own shit, because there's no, like, you know, you know, it's nice as a musician when things kind of like almost like patterns and blocks.
Sure.
Their music doesn't have that. It's like, we do that 11 times.
Where's the bridge? Come on.
Yeah. And then this, we do hit these two notes and then back to that 11 thing, but now it's 17 and then four.
Yeah.
And then one and then seven. It's just like,
yeah, there's not a lot of the pattern of the song.
Yeah. But anyway, I gave this 5 Doc Martens.
You gave this one 5. Okay, well, this one I liked better than Boris because it was a little faster tempo.
Yeah.
Great guitar and drums on this one. But like I said, I had no clue on the fucking lyrics until I went to the Melvins Wiki site. Which the lyrics you have pulled up here look like the ones I saw on that site as well. So I hate to think there's more than, you know, two people in this world that have sat down to try to decipher these out line by line.
You know, I shared it with you off mic, but yeah, as I told you, like when I was in the band Bloody Bedsheets, we all got to pick one song to cover, and our drummer picked this one, and it was, you know, I had to decipher the lyrics because there was no lyric sheet with Melvin shit, and there's no like internet for this kind of stuff. I mean, the internet existed, but
there's no songbook at Schmidt Music.
I looked, but no, it was sold out. Okay. Apparently, I wasn't the only person having this problem. But my God, try picking this shit out by ear. Which maybe that's how these guys did it too. But all right, track 3 though is called Ligature.
Like a man, you're in love.
gonna let you take the lead on this one, Andy.
Oh, I get to read? Okay.
Your thoughts on it. Yeah, you can
My thoughts on this one? Unintelligible rambling is what I said for the lyrics. You just cannot make out what the hell he's trying to say.
You know, we're three tracks in, and doesn't it feel like almost any attempt we make to describe anything about any song is going to be applicable so far to every tune?
Pretty much, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just, like I said, there's no hooks. There's no choruses, so you don't, you know, get the rhythm of the song. You don't get it, you don't find those hooks. So
yeah, it's definitely not music for someone who's addicted to the verse chorus right. bridge solo pattern.
They could have used a Mutt Lang here.
Do you think it? I want to know what Mutt Lang would have done with Melvins. The other thing, it's like I couldn't track down. Is it the Melvins or Melvins? I'm not sure. Is there an official?
Oh, good question. You know, I saw it both ways. Yeah. Okay. I'm unsure. I think it is Melvins.
Can you have a gender fluid band name, or be a band name that's pan? Like it's both, you know, it's like I identify as both Melvins and the Melvins.
Is it the Beatles or no, the Eagles or Eagles?
Or Beatles and the Beatles, yeah. I don't know. Or Kiss and the Kiss. Or my favorite, it actually kind of gets some of their fans a little irked, because I do it intentionally, is the Fish.
Oh, be careful, you motherfucker.
You motherfucker.
Oh, that's right. That's right, Greg. I got to be careful there. I've already pushed it too far with him once. It was a lot of work getting back in his good graces, and you know he's a powerful and attractive man.
Very much so.
Yeah, so I gotta keep things cool with the old Pods and Sods Craig. Right. Eric can go fuck himself, but but not Craig.
Yes.
All right, a little bit from the lyrics. I don't even know if this last word of this line is a word, but I can see you like a rel, like a man doe in law, and row, like some dance stone in less, and row stole. I might Nemo men cause, and lax.
It's beautiful.
It really is. I mean, seriously, I mean, you know, a guy who writes lyrics like this doesn't go to bed alone often.
No. Swimming in pussy.
I was thinking he was going to bed with a book with a pen, writing lyrics.
Should have had this be the opening song at my wedding reception.
Oh,
this
would have
been, you know, sealed the deal.
Melvins get a lot of offers to play weddings.
Wedding singers?
Yeah.
They're too busy doing bar mitzvahs, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure. Oh, is that because you think he's is Osborne a Jewish name?
Sure.
I don't think so. All right, there we went kind of off the rails. Uh-oh. There. Keeping her clean here, the next song, track four, is called It's Shove.
Thank you.
What do you got on this one, Nady?
This is my favorite song on the album by far. I give 6 out of 5 Doc Martens for this one.
Oh, by the way, I had 2 Doc Martens on the last track.
So. Yeah, that's about what I'd give it to.
Okay, so 6 out of 5 on this one, huh?
Yes.
You're really pushing her.
I said this resembles an actual song. It's got some driving drums and bass. I mean, these guys are just kicking ass in this one.
I agree.
It's moving. You throw on some awesome guitar licks on top of it. Lyrically, I'm still drawing a blank, but you know, hell, I can tap my foot and slap my knee with this one. So,
yeah, all right. I literally wrote down finally a drum beat. this is almost a real rock song.
Hell yeah!
So we almost said the exact same thing. This is almost like now it's something like this is a side of the Melvins I really dig because they do more of this later on. Like I said, Houdini and Stoner Witch are 2 records I would encourage people to check out. I know Houdini's a little further up in the list. Again, spoiler alert, but I will give Buzz a little bit of credit because I think the guitar tone on this record is really good, and especially for that grunge sound. And you're talking low budget recording before Pro Tools and all that stuff, and to capture that sound that actually is very much what it's like to see them live is not easy to do when you have a giant budget. So the fact that they're able to pull it off, I'm not exactly sure what he does. It has to be low tech, but I think the drum tone, the drum sound is actually for that boomy kind of sound is actually recorded pretty good too.
No, I really liked it shoved. Like you said, it's it resembles a song.
All right, well, that brings us to the halfway point before we flip it over to side 2 of the cassette, or we'll just pause the CD, I suppose. It's the 90s, right? Tell me a little bit about where do you fit in the grunge world? Are you a fan, not a fan? Did you buy in? Where did you come in if you did?
You
didn't, why not?
Fan of kind of the more traditional rock guys. I mean, I consider Soundgarden to be more of a, you know, metal rock band than a grunge band. Stone Temple Pilots, same thing. Alice in Chains, you know, these are all bands that had started a little before the whole grunge movement that I had heard of. So the fact that they got lumped into grunge when I was already thinking of them as kind of metal bands was a different turn. Now, Nirvana was the, you know, line in the sand where this is grunge, you know, for the masses.
Okay.
And that's how everyone learned about it. And right. I was never that big of a Nirvana fan. I mean, I can appreciate Nevermind, and I think there's some great songs on it. In Utero doesn't do much for me, but I understand what they've done to music and pop culture. I mean, they're definitely what do you want to call it, a scene shifter.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're,
I give them credit for what they did.
Yeah,
even though it's not particularly my cup of tea, if you will, but I can see where things, I mean, I can see where things changed.
Okay.
In the musical landscape. I think I told you this a long time ago when we met, but I saw Guns N' Roses in March of 92 play the Target Center here in Minneapolis. Soundgarden opened for them. And this is back in the days when, you know, Axl doesn't come out until Axl feels like playing.
Sure,
bullshit.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure, you know, the union guys love because they were probably making triple overtime in those days. But Soundgarden comes out at, you know, the show probably started at 8. They come out at 8:30, play for 45 minutes. Great set, and by the time they're done, people are kind of so-so. They're there to see GNR. They could give a shit.
The friends I know that went to that show did not come away with positive impressions of Soundgarden.
Oh, see, I thought they were great. I mean, I loved Outshined. And
yeah, sure.
They were playing all that. And I think it was...
I'm talking about small-minded people from Owatonna.
I'll say no more. Yeah. So when they get done, I think it was Cornell goes...
Love you, Ferno.
Cornell goes, hey, I hope you guys liked us, because who knows when the fuck Guns N' Roses is coming out.
Oh, wow.
And it was probably about another hour and a half before they did come out. You know, it was probably about 10:30, 11 before they started. But I thought they were great. And then, well, they were killing time between bands. They put on Smells Like Teen Spirit through the PA system at Target Center. And 16,000 people that were there to see GNR got up and were just rocking out and headbanging. So at that point, I thought, you know, grunge was out. But I still thought metal and grunge were kind of the same family, if you will. Like the people that went to see GNR could appreciate Nirvana.
I think so. But I think that's a really good comparison because both of those bands appeal to such a wide audience.
This is true.
You know, but were bands like, you know, Rat, Twisted Sister, Warrant, although I know Twisted Sister, I think, was done by 87 as far as officially doing anything, but that they did not share that same kind of mega power that of your AC/DC's, yeah, things of that nature. For me, it took a little bit to get pulled into grunge. Like, I actually bought the Nirvana record shortly after Smells Like Teen Spirit came out. I really got into that track right away. I had a hard time feeling the same way about the rest of the record. And as much as I can look at it now and think, I get why this is a huge record, and I get why it did what it did, and it definitely deserves the appreciation and I don't know, notoriety it gets, it was just never for me. But like when Outshine came out initially, I had to hear it a bunch to really get why I would like it. And same with like Man in the Box with Alice in Chains, and even like Pearl Jam with Alive. That seemed just a little goofy to me when it first came out. But once every one of those bands at different stages, with probably all within about a 3-month period, it seems like 10 years now, but like once each one of those clicked, it was done. And so like within, I'd say probably a 6 to 7 month period of my sophomore year in college, I was fully immersed in everything about the culture, the music, all that stuff. I was still listening to a lot of the stuff that I liked before, but I was happy to put a boot print on the Rat and Warrant and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
The tide had turned.
And I had turned with it is what I'm kind of getting at. It wasn't long before I was listening to Primus and all these other things.
Sure.
I am happy that, like, I got to the point where I was a little more open to all of it. Like, it's like, all right, I still like a lot of this stuff from the 80s.
Yep.
These bands were great and a huge part of my life, and I'm just going to like it all. I don't care. But there was that period where it was like, you know, it had to be this stuff, this hard, you know, heavy grunge stuff. Like I said, it was also easier, too, because, like, once you hit, you know, it was easier to accept like a lot of the lyrical and imagery stuff that went with hair metal when you're, you know, 13, 14, 15. But now you're 20 years old. You're trying to impress women with how intelligent you are. You're actually worried about shit like going to war, things of that nature. It just, after all that, it was easier for me to accept the messages that Soundgarden was singing. And buy into that kind of stuff. And like I said, the imagery was like, oh, it was like, I just go in my closet, you know. Oh, I own ripped jeans, a shitty pair of shoes, and a bunch of flannels and long underwear. It's Minnesota, don't you know?
Oh yeah.
So it was something that I definitely rode the wave with. You know, I loved the Lollapalooza. Yeah. I loved that whole thing that came along. Even though I think I tried to convince myself that I liked Perry Farrell as a person, and I thought I definitely gave fucking Jane's Addiction more of a shot than I think they deserve, because their music is just gnarly to me now. it's like fingers on a chalkboard, and I'm not just talking about the singer. I'm just talking about the sound of the whole band. It's like it's abrasive and rough and
true. They do have some standout songs, but yeah, they're few and far between.
Yeah, but that said, they were part of the movement. All that stuff was kind of happening. And like I said, music even changed in general. Like, you know, even like bands that have been around, like the Butthole Surfers or Sonic Youth, kind of got a bump from this kind of stuff, you know.
Well, just like the Melvins, too, getting signed to Atlantic.
Yeah. Well, oh, my God. This is probably the last time this happened, right? We're basically like a city. But, you know, like I said, they dragged everybody with them. All these bands into 96, 97 were getting deals just because of the Seattle Sound.
So where do you think the Seattle Sound ended? What was the last band?
Man. Oh, last band?
Yep.
To make a difference? Fuck. I mean, nobody really made it out of the other than the four.
Well, the last band to have hits out of Seattle, the Presidents of the United States.
Yeah.
But they were so far removed. They were like the last band standing in Seattle, I'm sure, that wasn't signed by the time 95, 96.
Yeah, I mean, that one record was a big record, but... Nobody looks back at them and puts them in the picture.
Well, John Lamrow does. He just had the guy on not too long ago.
Yeah, that was a good episode. I like that record, the first one. The second one with Mach 5 on it, it doesn't do it for me as much. Very kitschy. I mean, what the guitar player like has only two strings on his guitar.
Yes,
you know he went where Buzzo refused to go. I'm not putting shit on my guitar that I'm never going to use.
Right.
So like I said, I think everything was a process. You know, everybody that goes through from being a teenager to their 20s, you basically are a drastically different person every year for the next 14, 15 years. Until you basically, you're like, well, I'm going to work today, honey. This is actually who I am for the rest of my life, you know. But
how about second-tier grunge bands? Your Candleboxes, and I can't think of any other second-tier grunge bands right now.
Yeah, we should have looked that up.
Because I didn't see them on the list. But, you know, that first album they had was pretty big.
I took a little bit of offense to some of that stuff, like them. And who's another one? Hey, Collective Soul.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like they just seem like this kind of prepackaged version of what grunge should be. And then that fucking resulted in shit like goddamn Matchbox 20 coming along. Yeah. And it's just like, see, this is why you don't, you know, fucking turn like something like grunge into a corporate entity, because you just can't do it properly. I mean, Collective Soul, those guys are never doing heroin.
No.
Yeah, those fucking pussies.
Do the real
Matchbox 20.
Yeah.
Fuck them. You think they know what a needle looks like? This fucking. You think they know what it feels like to fucking run out of spots to put a needle? They got to put it between their toes.
I'm drawing a blank here. I'm drawing a blank here. Collective Soul, they did Lightning Crashes.
No, that was 8. There's another one, Live.
Live.
Yeah.
I remember I saw something on VH1 years ago where Live said, yeah, you know, our manager saw that the grunge wave was hidden just as we started. And they said, go down to the, you know, Salvation Army store and go buy some flannel shirts for your album cover.
Like, oh, man.
They were essentially, like, told to dress the part.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, rappers wearing Raiders hats back in the early
90s. Like 7 Mary 3, they were kind of at that tail end of that shit.
Oh,
they were
sure.
Still wearing flannel.
Yeah.
Who do you think faked it best out of, like, the 80s bands? I mean, Kiss did Carnival Souls, which I love. I think that's a great record. A lot of people, what's the one Warrant record that people like?
Few to choose from.
Yeah. Belly to Belly, I think.
Is that the name of it? Oh, God, I can't remember that far back now.
Get Sinzak on the phone.
We need a guest for the Rockin' Pod 4.
Yeah,
did
you dabble in any of that stuff? I know, like, I'm blanking. There was a bunch of bands that tried it. Like,
you know,
Bullet Boys did.
Bullet Boys, yes. Give a shout out here to my buddy Craig Smith, but the Monkees of all bands reunited with all four members in 1996 and did an album called Just Us, where they just all of them wrote the songs, performed the songs, you know, like a real band.
That's why nobody heard it.
Yeah, and it had a very grunge tone to it.
Really?
Which you would not have expected the Monkees to have a darker side. But some of the songs were, you know, light, poppy, fluffy stuff, your Davy Jones variety. But then some of it was kind of very dark and dank, which was very surprising. So even they jumped on the 96, you know, dark rock scene. So
you're a little younger than me. So it was grunge kind of hitting like in junior high, high school for you?
No, senior in high school in 91. Okay. So I had a friend.
Not that far then.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I'm old enough, damn it.
Yeah.
I had a friend
who. I'm just
trying
to paint a picture here. You know, you're definitely super old.
Who listened to college radio only. And the fact that she was in my car one day and I put on 93X, which was the heavy metal station at the time in Minneapolis. And they were playing. They were just starting to play Smells Like Teen Spirit. And she was like, what the hell is this doing on here? So she was shocked as hell that her little indie college rocks group was now making the mainstream hard rock station in town. That would have been, you know, like fall of 91. But I got on board with Soundgarden, Pearl Jam. I don't know if I really consider them grunge too. I mean, that 10 doesn't sound that grungy to me, if you will. It kind of sounds straight ahead rock and roll almost.
I think the fact that those four bands sound so different and are all considered grunge, to me, opens up what we consider grunge a little bit. I know I've definitely heard the Stone Temple thing a little bit.
Yeah.
I actually thought Stone Temple was one of those bands that was generic as fuck when they came out. I've grown to really appreciate what they did, that was my first reaction when I heard Sex Type Thing.
Sure.
And I was like, well, that's War Machine trying to be Soundgarden. But to me, there are more layers to it. It isn't just shit like the Melvins. It doesn't have to sound quite like that. To me, I always thought Nirvana was more of a punk band than they were grunge. But like, I get why they're lumped in. The whole thing comes from there. Basically, if you have a guitar, a bass player, and a drummer, and you're from Seattle, you were grunge.
Right.
Sorry, Queensryche.
I have a buddy who said like the last real musical genre that was created was rap. Because if you look at, you know, alternative and grunge, it was just a playoff of the post-punk of the late 70s, early 80s. So he always made the analogy. He's always waiting for the next, you know, new thing to come, and it just hasn't showed up.
All right.
And here we are in 2020.
Talking about grunge.
Yeah.
Let's get to side two. Side 2 opens up with the track Zodiac, or it's, I guess, should we call it Side 2? Fuck, I don't know where they would have broke this damn thing.
I would have bought, 91 I was still buying tapes, so I'll go with your Side 2.
Okay, Side 2 is, I'm not even sure, I've never seen this cassette, so I could be wrong. with an 8-minute track, you might only have three on Side 1, but...
That's true.
Anyway, track 5. Zodiac comes in at 4 minutes and 15 seconds, so a little bit longer than some of these other ones. What do you got here, Andy?
This was my second favorite track on the album. Nice. I thought I was blown away by the guitar work. Buzz really laid it down on here. And again, these guys are awesome drum and bass players. Lorax and Grover. I mean, I am impressed with their musicianship. I mean, it's this very dark and, you know, slow music, but it is impressive. I mean, you can tell they can play.
Good point.
It does to me. I mean, I get it, to be honest with you. I remember going to clubs in Minneapolis around this time. When it, you know, especially when I first moved up here, and seeing kind of these local bands that kind of drew a little bit of attention, because when you listen to this now, it's like, how did anybody ever get into this? But you kind of had to be part of the thing to kind of get it. I mean, you would actually like meet girls and then try to fuck them at a show like this. You know what I mean? It wasn't all dance clubs. You know what I mean? And you know, looking good. You know, you could stink. You know, I mean, I was never a pot smoker, but you know, you could smell like a bong hit with stale beer and still, you know, score if you had game.
My days.
I had plenty of stale beer, but I didn't have bong hits or game. So I went home alone most of the time. But
some things done for change.
That's why I got married. I thought it was a fun riff. This is almost, I don't know, like Sabbath on steroids a little bit. It's kind of, you know, and there's a lot of kind of Sabbath, you know, influence on these guys for sure. Oh, yeah. But this one is more riffy than a lot of what he's done here. Yeah. So yeah, I think a guitar work I would agree with. I don't know, the way I said it like this, kind of like how fans of Green Day would probably have a hard time listening to most like real punk. Like the stuff,
sure.
or the stuff that influenced Green Day. That's probably a better way to put it. They might like Green Day, but they would really have a hard time with like JFA or the Dead Kennedys or stuff that. You know,
Black Flag.
Melvins are a hard pill to swallow for fans that probably really enjoyed Alice in Chains or Nirvana, that kind of stuff.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
You know, because unless you were a fan of the Melvins and then those bands, but if you were like, I love Teen Spirit and that got me into, you know, Man in the Box. And then I listened to Melvins because a fucking Kurt Cobain said I'd like this shit. This is probably a little difficult.
Kind of like my buddy's sister who had Metallica's Black Album, but probably was not going to be going back to Ride the Lightning.
Exactly. So and again, you can hate the Black Album, but you're not being honest if you don't understand why that became massive.
Oh, sure.
Over the other records are plenty successful too, but. I don't know. We'll skip the lyrics on this one. Track 6, It's called If I Had an Exorcism.
It's not like that you can feel just like a two much more. Hanging my neck like feels too good to be real. Like somebody took a coat hanger, munched it and tore it from the side. It's just a stinger.
Now, this kind of reminded me, you remember the old folk song, If I Had a Hammer?
Yeah.
I had a hammer in the morning. I wish
who
I had.
Who doesn't?
A...
No, of course.
Trini Lopez shout out on the Cobras and Fire podcast. I wish I had a hammer and started beating the hell out of my ears when I heard this one. This one did not do much for me.
Zero Doc Martens.
Zero Doc Martens. And he almost did kind of like, you remember the old character actor Peter Lorre from the old like 40s movies? He was in Casablanca. Rick, help me.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
He kind of does a Peter Lorre impression, you know, kind of like Igor from Frankenstein.
Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the song kicks off with kind of random drums with Buzzo singing between. So there's no actual, like, music. It's just drumming at the very beginning with, yeah. with again, can you really call it a melody? This record feels damp. Like, you can almost, like, smell, like wetness when you're listening to it. The skies feel overcast while you're getting to this part of the record anyway. Yeah. I really like Buzz's playing on this song, though. That long single note, I know it seems dumb, where he hits it right at the end there. I really like the way that kind of carried out the end of the track. So it gets three Doc Martens from me.
More than generous.
Maybe it's something else that I was reading or dealing with. Oh, I have a Young Frankenstein reference.
Oh, nice.
All right, so let's get to track 7. This one is called Your... Oh, wait. But before we go to track 7, let me just read the lyrics to this because I can read them all. There aren't that many. So for the lyrics for it's, If I Had an Exorcism are this. It's not like you could feel just... Like you, what you want more metal, heh. Hanging from your neck like feels too good to be real. Like somebody took a coat hanger, munched it and tore it from the sign. Stin, stern, stin, din. This is my favorite line.
I mean, right there. I mean, that's up there with McCartney's Yesterday. Come on.
Yeah, I'm starting to get why Eric Miller says you like to beat jokes to death. Do you have another lyricist? Maybe Dylan?
Vocal styling-wise, this is kind of reminiscent of Dylan. I don't understand what the hell either one of them are singing.
Yeah,
so.
All right.
You get a lead nerve, Bucko.
Oh, God, Melvin should do a record with Dylan.
Ooh, Melvin's no one Dylan, would know what the
or
fuck
it would be Dylan saying. And Melvin's.
Yeah, I got to give Dylan props first. No, top
he,
billing.
He would insist on it, that the fucking plagiarist. All right, so the next song is called I'm sorry.
You're blessed.
You're blessed. Okay, this comes in at 3 minutes and 7 seconds. What do you have for me on this one, Andy?
I thought there was some great guitar work on top of the drums and bass finally. Like, I could hear the guitar riff over the bass and drums for once. They weren't as overpowering as they've been throughout the whole album. But other than that, the song didn't really do much for me.
Yeah, not a lot for me either. Again, he kind of opens up with more off-time drums that I really don't know how to describe. But again, back to the guitar tone, I wrote down that I love it, especially for an 89 indie record. I literally wrote this down. I think the guitar tone on this is literally better than like Dawkins' Breaking the Chains record. And that was something that was done in a studio, and you got a guitar player like George Lynch.
Sure.
And people are going to like, that's a preposterous statement. I'm like, I don't know, that tone sounds cheap on that record. And it might have been because they probably didn't have the money to do a lot of stuff.
Sure.
You know what I mean? But the fact that like somebody in Seattle could do this, you know, and with, you know, recording to 2-inch tape or whatever the hell they used, but
in 1990.
Yeah. So, and like I said, the drums sound good too. The record closes out with a track called Cow. Second longest song on the record. It's 4 minutes and 31 seconds. Well, what do you have here, Andy?
This was my third favorite track from the album. Actually, the three that I've named are the actual three tracks that I liked from the album.
Nice.
So it's my third. It's an interesting song because, like you said, it's 4.5 minutes, but after like the last 2.5 minutes of the song, it's just Crover going off.
Yeah.
Like I'm like, is this supposed to have been like a demo? Is this where they were like just miking up the drums and they're trying to figure out what they wanted the sound to be and they just let him go off? Or, you know, was this possible? I'm curious if this was intentional where they just let him go off on a 2.5 minute drum solo to close it off.
It definitely felt, because it doesn't sound deliberately like a drum solo the way it starts. You know, it's just kind of a... And the fact that, like, it does kind of carry into, I don't know, a bit of a solo. I'm almost with you. Like, they just decided, fuck it.
Yeah.
They might have just, like...
go grab a beer.
Yeah. We'll see in 2.5 minutes. But,
well, it's Seattle. Let's go grab a Rainier Draft.
Yeah, there you go. Rainier. But, yeah... I think it's kind of a neat way to end the record, to be honest with you. It definitely kind of encapsulates... The different way these bands from Seattle approached recording and writing and doing albums, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So it definitely wasn't the typical, you know.
No, nothing about this album is typical.
No,
I give them credit for that.
And I think a lot of that. Now, while this was definitely not meant for mainstream, like you can take a record like Smells Like Teen or Nevermind, and understand how even though that was really harsh at the time. You kind of look at it like this still kind of hits it checks the boxes that a hit record needs.
Oh, totally.
All that stuff is kind of spawned out of this idea that, like, let's just break down the walls and let's paint outside the lines, that kind of stuff. Let's look at everything different. And this definitely encapsulates that. I think, even though I probably won't listen to this record ever again intentionally, I think it belongs on the list.
Yes, I can see this being a momentous album and groundbreaking for what it is. And for people who are into sludge metal and stoner metal out there, I could see where they totally dig this vibe. Like this is playing to them right there.
Yeah.
So.
And Dale Crover can take a tip from me too, and like have a signature drum kit that doesn't have a hi-hat.
Yeah, who needs to carry all that shit on the load?
Yeah, exactly. A little less to carry around. Maybe that was the necessity is the mother of invention. Lack of necessity is the mother of invention. It's like, I don't need to carry this, so sure. I won't. If I don't use it, then I don't need it.
That's right.
So he created his own sound by being lazy. So. I mentioned just a quick note that they definitely had. I think they had 9 different drummers over the course of their career. None of them longer than 4 or 5 years. or I'm bass players. Yep. Kurt, thank you very much. Like I said, this is kind of like I said, it was Tool's Idiot Stepbrother, and I wrote down Sabbath Idiot Stepbrother. So you're not the only one who likes to take a joke and beat it to death. Right. For me, it's the Idiot Stepbrother. But or maybe this is good. This is all random gibberish I have scribbled here. Sewell. Sabbath and Tool had a baby that died, and it was reanimated with the brain of young Frankenstein. That's nice. The Melvins to me.
Very nice. Now, to summarize the album, my thoughts were this is the perfect soundtrack to listen to while you're waiting in line at the methadone clinic. So,
nice one.
This would have been on my Walkman in 1991 if I was in line at the methadone clinic.
Oh, nice. Maybe if. When. Dale Crover also only goes through one drum skin. Like the rest of his, they last years. But that floor tom, that fucker gets replaced daily.
Oh, yeah. I did hear an interview with them. I found an interview with them from Sound Opinions in Chicago.
Oh, really?
Pretty interesting stuff. They were saying, like, he's supposed to use some much heavier drumsticks. I think it shows in some of these songs that he's really beating the hell out of it. That's where I get the John Bonham thing.
Sure.
Because he's just beating the hell out of those things. I haven't seen a beating that bad since I went to the blacksmith tent at the Renaissance Festival. So. But don't bump.
You walked into your son's room when he was on 14.
No comment.
I would encourage anybody that has never heard either one of these guys interviewed is to spend the next 5 years just listening to the Melvins on occasion and then looking up one of their interviews, because it is amazing. Like especially King Buzzo is like, he's articulate.
Oh, yeah.
He's sharp. And of course, he looks like he's a homeless man with a out of control afro. Is like, you know, Shaka Khan does his hair.
Featuring Rufus?
Oh yeah, featuring Rufus. he has no votes for the Hall of Fame, so they're fucked. But any closing thoughts on this?
I forgot to mention that the song Boris reminded me of the song from Clerks, Berserker. My love for you is like a berserker. Would you like some making Clerks. Fuck berserker? Kind of had the same vibe, and I was curious if maybe they were trying to do a Boris parody or something. Now,
when did Clerks come out? You're right.
They would have recorded that in 93.
Yeah. So you were saying maybe the writers for that were going for that.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Kind of a monotonous drum, you know, slow burn.
Yeah.
So
I kind of like some of that stuff, but did you want some? You were going to mention some shout outs to.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, I got to give shout outs to my podcast groupie brothers. Of course, we got, you know, Sean Cullen.
Oh, nice.
We got Bill Ellum. And then
is it Ellum or Elam?
Elam. I'm sorry. I fucked that up. And then the one I really like, Jay Sabluski.
Jay-Z.
Or when I first met him at Rockin' Pod years ago, and he told me his name, I was like, how the fuck am I going to remember that? So I always say Jay Sabluchis when I think of his name. That's kind of the rhyme I came up with so I can remember. Jay Sabluchis. Jay Sabluski. That's how I kind of remember how to pronounce his name. So.
That's how we do it in Minnesota.
Oh, hey, yeah. Don't you know?
Don't you know?
Tater tot hot dish.
Tater tots. I just remember first time I met Jay Sabluski, he said hello, and then about 8 seconds later, he had piggybacked me to the other end of the arena, or the Rock and Pod room, I should say, arena, and he was gone, like a fucking, what's that thing, the coyote chases Roadrunner.
Roadrunner.
Yeah, that's Jay-Z, he's a fucking moving machine, man. Thanks a lot, Andy. I really appreciate you coming down. This is my new little endeavor I'm trying on the side of Cobras and Fire. Whatever, never mind. You were a wonderful first guest host.
Oh, thank you.
Hopefully we'll have you back. Maybe you do another episode down the road.
Hell yeah.
All right, we'll talk about that off mic and figure out what record we're going to do. But today was, of course, we started off at 25 with Melvin's Bullhead. Now I'm going to ask everybody who comes on the show to tell me where the album that we just reviewed landed on their own personal re-ranking, which means I'm asking everybody who comes on to re-rank their own personal list using only these 25 records. Now, for the listener, what I'm asking anybody that comes on to do is to any record they hadn't heard automatically goes to the back. In other words, it's just not fair to rank something lower than something you never heard.
Sure.
I'm just, you know, it's probably going to fuck me up when I'm trying to do the math at the end. but you, there is a decent, there's five records on here that are new to me. How many had you not heard?
Eight of them.
Okay.
So 8 out of 25.
Okay, so with that in mind, what number did the Melvin's bullhead come in at?
So I gave it number 17.
Which is exactly 9 spots off of past the 8. So right
pretty
now,
pretty good at math there, Baco.
Of every record on this list that you've heard, this is worse than all of those.
Well, I do like 3 songs off of it. And I'd probably actually listen to It Shoved again because I did like that. So.
All right, fair enough. So something might squeeze its way into your playlist. For me, I had this at 16, so not a whole lot higher than you. The stuff I have below it, I don't have a whole lot of love for, but we'll see. I mean, maybe as I go through this, my list, the thing is, like, I'm going to do every record, so, like, right. My list might actually be a little fluid by the time I'm done. Things are going to slide around a little bit. Sure. I don't know how transparent I can be with that. I'll do my best.
You're going to have one hell of an Excel spreadsheet, though, by the time you're done with talking to 24 other people.
All right. So. Well, 23 if you come back.
Well, that's true. There we go.
There's some more quick math for you.
And now, if you can find someone who's an L7 fan, hats off to you, brother.
There's no way Joey Haney won't do that one. If he was down for the Melvins.
That's true. L7 was one of those bands I remember, but they were kind of flash in the pan as far as I can recall.
Yeah, I like the Pretend That We're Dead song off that record, and I at one point owned it. I might still. Wow. I just don't remember much else on it, so I'm looking forward to kind of getting back into that one. There's a lot of these that are just kind of forgotten that I know I've heard.
Oh,
they
sure.
just weren't something that was a standout for me. To your point, John Lamoureux has already volunteered to take any episode nobody wants.
Oh, nice.
So I got that in my pocket, you know what I mean? That guy could probably just sit back and let him go.
Be careful. He might start doing the other 24 albums as well. So.
Maybe he'll do like a bizarro list. What would be the bizarro grunge? Like he'll do like a 25 hair metal or something? Or
teen pop.
K-pop.
K-pop. Ooh, yeah. Even better.
Like all the kids are saying. Well, before we get out of here, Andy, we don't always hang out all that often. Anything else you want to get into?
Well, I would like to thank you for having me on here on Cobras and Fire. Although, you know, I have been on.
This is actually a sidecast.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're on Whatever, Never Mind.
Whatever, Never Mind. A subcast.
Yes. That's a good one.
Cobras
yeah.
and Fire. But, you know, I've been on the Pods and Sods Network several times.
Yes.
So now it's a little bit of a letdown that I'm on the Hydrox Cookie of podcasts compared to being on that Oreo double stuff of the Pods and Sods. So,
oh man, you know, you're hurting my feelings here, man. I'm gonna cry. And then I'm going to get angry, I'm going to do like a lash out side episode.
You motherfucker.
Yeah, no. I actually, you know, when Craig was out, I didn't even know that you guys had, like, talked or knew each other. I don't know, for whatever reason. The three of us should have fucking got together.
I realized that after the fact, yes. Because him and I went out to dinner, and then he said he was going out to breakfast with you the next day or something.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Next December, because he wants to do his
annual
trek.
He took you to
Paisley Park,
and you got him sick.
You motherfucker!
And
I did not know that.
Yeah, coronavirus.
Oh,
he had it first, just like the jerk sock joke. Apparently, he invented jerk sock. So.
Although Ken Mills will tell you, you know, Ken Mills was jerk socking back in the day.
Of all the things to claim you invented, the jerk sock, it can't be one of them. We had a fantasy football trophy. I used to be commissioner of a league, and it was called Lord Jerk Sock. And you know who named it? This guy.
Nice.
That was decades before I ever heard Pods and Sods. Not only that, but I brought it up on the episode before I ever started listening. I didn't really start getting into Pods and Sods until I met Craig and Eric at the first Rockin' Pod.
Oh, sure.
Other than the couple things that Loose, like episodes that he would turn me on to, like, oh, you should check this one out, sure. In particularly. But it was nice to hear the two of them talk together. I don't know, whatever it is, it's just maybe because you only get it once a year, it just seems much more magical. Maybe that's
kinda
the secret.
Like,
Loose and I should only talk once a year.
You know, once a year, it's very magical. It's learning more about Andy Shaw than anyone wanted to, right there. But,
right on. That's what I like to do. I like to expose the inner belly of the human.
There we go.
So yeah, your son jacks off, and you're disappointed to your wife. that's the takeaway from
son of a bitch. The Melvin's
record.
You know me so well.
All right, Andy, let's get out of here. I'm going to try to end every one of these shows with this. It's going to be basically grunge isn't dead, but whatever. Never mind. Sorry. What's up? Oh, well, I can take that.
Some important podcasting going on here.
This week on RVER, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
Oh, that new doctor is drop dead gorgeous.
Oh, please, he's just another Ivy League educated surgeon with good hair.
No, he's different.
Nurses, we got a Class C motorhome with a detached driver's side mirror. Meet me in the OR. Stat.
Right away, doctor.
No, she's on break. I'll handle this one.
Oh, you conniving little...
When your RV really needs saving, Progressive has you covered. See if you could save with a leader in RV insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Covered subject to policy terms.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.